you like me to proceed?
Sure.
All right.
Did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I understand I have 10 minutes in total.
Right.
All right, this has been scheduled. I'll attempt to reserve some time, two or three minutes.
Yeah.
Two minutes.
Name it, and then I'll run the clock.
2 minutes.
I'm saving you. So when it says zero, you'll still have 2 minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Charles Horner. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Tico Johnson. Mr. Johnson, according to the evidence, has been parking more than three vehicles on his property as a use appurtenant to his permitted home since January 1957, before the adoption of the 1957 Seattle Zoning Ordinance. That use continued over the decades after that period, and both before and after the adoption in 1999 of the prohibitive ordinance as on appeal in this case. Over one decade after the adoption of that three-vehicle prohibition in 2010, the city began issuing citations to Mr. Johnson for this longstanding use, as well as for alleged junk storage in relation to the same vehicles, which the trial court dismissed an alternative basis. And this was brought pursuant to a citation procedure, Chapter 23.91, Seattle Municipal Code, which provides only for an appeal to the hearing examiner, which is in contrast to the notice of violation procedure under a different chapter, 23.90, which can only be enforced through the municipal court at a civil trial. So therefore, there was only an appeal to the hearing examiner. Mr. Johnson appealed. His contention was not mitigation. The contention was that he didn't do it and he wasn't liable for the fine.
I'd like to make sure I understand, in a short, succinct statement, what your argument is with respect to 1983. Is it that the procedure that you've just described, where you appear before a hearing examiner to contest the citation for junk car storage, is it your contention that that violates procedural due process because at that hearing, the hearing examiner took the position, and the city's now backing up the hearing examiner's position by saying, you don't get to present evidence of nonconforming use at that hearing? Or is that your contention?
That is the contention. It's really quite a simple issue, and I'll say that was also the policy announced by the code compliance analyst, who was the city's representative one of those
hearings. Do you have a case? Can you cite a case that is, in your opinion, similar on the facts and law that says that is the sort of scheme that you can challenge under 1983 on procedural due process grounds?
I believe we do, Your Honor. I cite a number of cases in the briefs. I'll highlight a couple that I think are helpful to highlighting this situation. One of them is the South Line case, I believe a federal case out of Connecticut, which did involve a nonconforming use issue as to whether year-round use of houses was permitted on lots that were less than conforming size. And what happened there is the city said that under their ordinance, their policy, they would refer to certain records. They would allow the homeowner to present certain documents. However, they wouldn't allow them to present testimony, and they wouldn't allow them to present neighbor's testimony. So it's a case where, unlike in this case, at least there was some sort of process for presenting the evidence. But even there, the federal judge said that was insufficient, that you, when you're going to be deprived of a vested right, as in this state and Connecticut law, and I think every other state that I'm aware of, if you're going to be deprived of that, you have a right of a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and not being allowed to present testimony was not a meaningful opportunity to be
now,
heard.
And I have another one. The city argues, they say, well, you did have procedural due process because look at all the courts you get to go to. You get to go up to Superior Court, and then if the Superior Court rules against you, you can come to this court. And if we were to hold that you were correct, that the hearing examiner should have allowed that kind of testimony, or should have done something different, that now you're going to be vindicated, and so that you've had due process. You've been able to argue your point.
I don't believe that's what the city is arguing in this case, because the city is maintaining that there's no possibility of making that defense in the only avenue of appeal that it provided. It appears to be what the city is essentially arguing is you have a right to go into court or to the hearing examiner, and you can talk, and the finder of fact isn't going to tell you to shut up or kick you out of the room or anything like that. But the touchstone of procedural due process is a meaningful opportunity to be heard. So this is the only forum the city provided And the city has referred to an unrelated procedure that went to a completely different forum. The Department of Planning and Development operates under an independent schedule. They're saying, well, you know, that's the only way to do it, but you got to come in and talk about your legal nonconforming use. But there was no possibility of it being considered. That's no better than them just rejecting the evidence or ruling it inadmissible, essentially, is what happened, or telling you you can't testify to this. So we believe that there hasn't been due process because there hasn't been a meaningful opportunity. Another case I'll revert to is the Moore case that's cited in the
brief. Redmond versus Moore.
Yes, Redmond versus Moore, involving the license, department license, saying we're suspending your license. You get no hearing at all. Good luck with the municipal court, straightening out your record. But for now, you're an illegal driver. This is similar to this case in a lot of ways, because here we have a process and a policy where the hearing examiner, and I'm not suggesting that the hearing examiner herself made this policy or was some personal predilection of hers. This was a city policy as instructed to her. Essentially telling you to go, it's part of the city government, but it's a completely different department, and it involves a completely different process and has no nexus whatsoever to the appeal procedure. So we'd say that the Moore case and this case, certainly functionally, they seem the same. Okay, I'll admit one has to do with licensing, and this had to do with legal nonconforming uses, but the principles are pretty fundamental when it comes to procedural due process, a right to be heard in a meaningful time in a meaningful manner. Of course, the Matthews versus Eldridge factors, which you almost can't even analyze that in this case because there was no meaningful hearing. So talking about should have happened before the deprivation or after, it's almost beside the point.
The deprivation in this case being
the fines.
Citation.
The citation and fine, which is this case law, being fined and having to pay money as a property interest.
Are you making a substantive due process argument?
Not here today, Your Honor. This is primarily a procedural due process case at this point, both under LUPA and under Section 1983. Of course, we believe that the trial judge erred, did not even reach the procedural due process issue in her opinion. It was brought up.
And wasn't that largely because he had prior citations and therefore had noticed that there was a corrective procedure, and the court did remand to mitigate as to the one once the procedure was utilized?
I would say that it's not, I don't believe that's the case here. You have a right to a hearing at the time that you're given a hearing. There's talk about did he resort to the procedure. Note that the procedure took months and that three citations had already been issued and decided, essentially within the time frame that would have taken. And there's no nexus between the two procedures. The fact is he was entitled to process at the time.
If the Superior Court had said, we agree that procedure is inappropriate and struck all the citations, would you agree you'd had the due process that he was entitled to?
If the citations were stricken, there still would have been the question of due process before the hearing examiner. The right to due process is without respect to the merits of the case, even. It's an absolute right, and one is entitled to nominal damages, even. And of course, then the attorney fee issue, of course, comes in and looms in that connection. So I see my time's up, so we'll stop here.
Good morning. I'd like to first address...
Counsel, let's help cut to the chase. He was cited.
Your name for the record, please.
Yes, Patrick Downs.
Thank you.
Mr. Downs, the citations aren't for failure to have a permit or failure to register or failure to establish, therefore having vehicles or junk on the premises. And yet, the reason he's cited is for failure to establish. He's never told, here's the process to defend. He's never given a chance to quash the citations. Why isn't it a blatant due process violation?
Your Honor, he did have an opportunity to quash or defend against the citations. At the first citation hearing, the examiner told him that you needed to go to the Department of Planning and Development and establish this use for the record. And that's what the code requires. It requires a couple of things.
So, but he was clearly not entitled to defend on that basis at that hearing.
He was entitled. He presented what Mr. Johnson claimed at the first citation hearing was that he had a nonconforming use, presented no evidence. So no, the examiner did not bar him in the first citation hearing, the second or the third, did not bar him from providing any evidence that what he of the nature that he wanted to. This isn't Southline, this isn't Moore, where somebody was precluded from putting forward evidence. What the examiner concluded, and rightfully concluded, that you can bring this evidence before me, but the protocol that the code establishes that you need to follow to establish any use is to obtain a permit from DPD. Not if it's a nonconforming use, that's what the code requires. If it's to be permitted from the get-go,
but it's not a permit per se.
Well, it is a permit. The specie of it is that you're establishing the use for the record.
But it doesn't say you can't have a legal nonconforming use without a permit. It says a nonconforming use is recognized and has to be established for the record, which has practical enforcement implications. But
what the definition of a nonconforming use is there's two parts. One is that the use was established at a time when it was legal, and it uses the word established, which has, it's a term of art within Title 23, and or that you've used the establish it for the use prong. And in order to establish any use under the code, under 2304.002A, the code says that to establish a use, you need to go to the Department of Planning and Development. The entire structure of the city's regulatory process is permit-driven. It's either you've gotten a permit back in the day to authorize that use, or if you didn't, the way you do it is you go to the department, they're the experts, they know the records, and they will establish the use in a code enforcement context.
Well, I noticed that in the TIPS, that tip sheet that's in the record, the city explains why would somebody want to establish a nonconforming use, and it gives examples of situations where you would want to, because let's say you've got a triplex and now you can only have a single or a duplex, let's say, but you've got a triplex and you're going to want to sell it or you're going to want to expand it or something. So before you get a chance to do that, you're going to want to go down and establish that it was a nonconforming use. But I noticed that none of those tips are, let's say you want to avoid a citation under present law that says that, you know, you have to pay $150 if you have more than three cars. It doesn't say that. You know, and in fact, it seems to me that, as counsel argues, that there's no linkage. You know, you don't, it's kind of catch 22. The city comes down and cites you for having too many cars and says, well, you know, if you don't want this to happen to you again, you can go down and get some kind of a statement from the other office of the city. But as far as this citation goes, you know, you're stuck with it. You have to pay it, even though the code says a nonconforming use is recognized.
I agree with you that the TIP does not cast this requirement to establish a nonconforming use for the record in a code enforcement context. But the director's rule that implements 2342102, the section that we're talking about, casts this squarely in a code enforcement context. And it says that in a code enforcement context, you may be called to establish the use for the record. And that director's rule, as a rule, has the same effect as, well, this court knows, as adopted law. And it's the intent of that rule is to direct individuals like Mr. Johnson to go to the department.
But he's stuck with his first citation, at least. You know, under your theory, he can't get away from that citation. He violated the law, according to you, by having five cars, even though, according to a different view of the law, he didn't violate any law because he had a nonconforming use. So he's stuck with that citation no matter how promptly he gets a ruling from the department, which apparently can only happen after about 6 months, and so in the meantime he's gotten three or four more citations.
Well,
Why isn't that wrong? I mean, it seems like the essence of the argument, as I'm hearing it, is that there is a disconnect here. The city has a scheme that enables the city to fine people and bring revenues into the city's coffers, and Mr. Johnson ran afoul of it, and he's not going to be the last one. I mean, this is going to continue because this scheme goes on. It's going to continue that if the city goes out and cites people for too many cars, and if they haven't previously been aware of the idea that you can keep yourself out of trouble with the city by going down and talking to the other department, then they're going to have to pay those citations too, even though they shouldn't have to, because they aren't violating the law. So it's just going to go on and on unless somebody stops it, and it doesn't look like the city's inclined to stop it.
Well, Mr. Johnson had the opportunity, as soon as he was cited, to do the diligence that he extended to this process, to go to the department to determine that the non-conforming use could be established for the record. And had he done that before, or even any time prior to the examiner's hearing, the code allows the examiner to recognize that, you know, an individual has taken efforts to address
But the code doesn't tell him that if you apply, we're going to vacate the first citation. It doesn't tell you that after the citation hearing and it's become final, that if you apply, the city must vacate the citation, because you always had a right to establish the nonconforming use.
You're right. The code does not set up a means where you can vacate a citation if you establish the use after the examiner's hearing. But what the code does allow, it allows Mr. Johnson to do exactly what he did, to establish the use for the record. He could have done that at any time. As soon as he received that citation, he could have contacted the department, said, what do I do about this? He would have learned that you can establish it for the record, and that would have addressed that first $150 citation. But he didn't do that. What Mr. Johnson did, not only after the first citation, but after the second and the third, is say, I don't have to go through the process that city code requires. I mean, the code, 2390 is clear in terms of what the code requires and how you establish a nonconforming use.
I mean,
use.
Usually, isn't it? I mean, when you get a citation and it says that you've violated the law, and you have a hearing to contest it, then that's what you do, is you go to the hearing, okay? And you're saying, no, he had to do more than go to the hearing. He should have gone down to the department, and then he should have showed up with this permit. But then it seems to me, based on how I understand how this process works, he would have showed that to the hearing examiner. The hearing examiner would have said, you know, this isn't my department. You know, I don't do this. I just noticed that you violated, you've had too many cars on your parking lot.
Well, as a practical matter, the hearing examiner first of all, the Department of Planning and Development in this context, there was a fourth citation because Mr. Johnson still didn't respond. But once he had gone to the department to establish the record, the department withdrew that citation. Further, the examiner, as a matter of her discretion, could have stayed the proceedings and allowed Mr. Johnson to proceed on his way to establish the use for the record. But that didn't happen. Mr. Johnson had no interest in, you know, complying with what city code allows as a process.
Well, perhaps if the code required that it be stayed pending an opportunity, a window of time to establish, that would satisfy due process. But here, the citation issues because it's not a defense.
Well, I want to speak just real briefly, answer your question, and talk about due process. Mr. Johnson has had due process, and the city is arguing that between the examiner's hearing, Superior Court, and this hearing, he's had absolute due process to defend. And you're right, Your Honor, if this court says, well, the city erred in its position, then Mr. Johnson prevails and the citations are gone. But so I guess that's my response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
Yes. Essentially, what the city is doing here is essentially trying to shift the duty of providing due process from itself onto Mr. Johnson by suggesting he could have done this or he could have done that. Maybe he could have gone and gotten a writ of prohibition from some court somewhere to stop this whole thing or whatever. But
the first citation and the first hearing examiner did say that comes from the department. Wasn't he on notice to go there?
And I will point out that he was not told at the hearing about this process. That was never brought up. I believe the record reflects that came up. The hearing occurred, the first citation hearing, and they went through the process and addressed the issue. The fact of a procedure, an unrelated procedure through the department, was never mentioned until she had issued her decision. And as Ms. Bochum, the city compliance analyst, stated at the second hearing, the citation is effective when it's issued and certainly when it's affirmed.
I understand that. But as to the second and third or any subsequent citations, wasn't he on notice of that he had the opportunity, the procedure to avoid other citations by virtue of the application process?
Well, there was some notice, but on the other hand, there's evidence in the record that the city misinformed him about the process. There's a March 2011 letter from another code analyst higher up in the chain who said, "We understand you may have been misinformed. Now here's what you do." By that time, the third citation had already been issued.
What do you think? Your argument of procedural due process implies that there's something wrong with the process. Now, there's nothing wrong with the city objective here, right? I mean, they can have a new law and they can say, look, times have changed. You know, we just don't want so many cars on lots, and we're going to use our enforcement powers to make that happen. How do you think they should have what would cure this defect that you allege?
If there was to be a cure to the defect, the simplest one would be to give the hearing examiner not state is the policy that she can address nonconforming use, but say that the policy is she can and make it clear in the jurisdiction so that you can defend in the forum that's been provided. This sense of established, there's a confusion being created about established. If a nonconforming use isn't established, then it certainly can't be recognized for the record under the city ordinance. It flies in the face of the common law of nonconforming use. The hearing examiner should be able to recognize that. Now, and one more point, the Racema decision, also the teaching of that is that this permit process that the city clings to is not the only way that the city recognizes nonconforming uses. That there was no indication in that case that process had been completed. The director simply recognized it under the common law that is protected, and the court affirmed that and made its observations. So I will conclude there because I believe I've answered the question. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.